Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Tin Ticket, The Heroic Journey of Australia's Convict Women by Deborah J. Swiss. Narrated by Corinne Davies. Introduction. Life's most interesting journeys often begin with a surprising coincidence. Sometimes a story finds you. In 2004, I traveled to Tasmania to join two wilderness treks, challenging myself among a group of highly experienced trekkers. I completed the 80-kilometer overland track in the Cradle Mountain, Lake St. Clair National Park, and climbed Mount Ossa, Tasmania's highest peak. I also explored the Bay of Fires in Mount William National Park, where huge Aboriginal middens mark Muscle Row Point. During a break from hiking, I happened to meet Christina Henry, a Tasmanian commemorative artist whose work honours the 25,000 women exiled from the British Isles to Australia. She was standing in line ahead of me in a post office in Launceston, Tasmania. Without knowing that I'm a writer, she turned to me and said, "I have a story I want to tell you." I knew little about this chapter in history until that day I stood in the queue chatting with Christina. Out of the blue, she began to describe the piece of paper she held in her hand, a pattern for a christening bonnet. Christina was mailing one of 900 bonnet patterns to a volunteer, helping her create a travelling memorial honouring the 900 infants and children who died at the Cascades Female Factory. Newspapers of the day had labelled the damp, converted distillery hidden under the cliffs of Mount Wellington the Valley of the Shadow of Death. This was the prison that housed the women featured in The Tin Ticket. The backdrop for these women's lives exposes a time in history still unknown to many. The journey of the convict women began in slums all across the British Isles, where the destitute struggled to survive. Profit trumped morality, as wigged and powdered parliamentarians sold grain at inflated prices to other countries and ignored widespread hunger and homelessness among their own citizens. High levels of unemployment, created by the Industrial Revolution and an exploding urban population, left a working-class girl with few options in the early 1800s. Even a woman fortunate enough to find work was always paid less than a man. When thousands of soldiers returned from the Napoleonic Wars, many female factory workers lost their jobs to the men. The Glasgow Courier suggested that if a woman was not ugly, she might find relief in prostitution instead of a crippling life in the textile mills. Many girls had no choice but to resort to selling their bodies, which was not a crime in 19th century Britain. Others staved off starvation by collecting and selling bones, singing ballads for pennies, picking pockets, or pilfering small items that might be traded for food or a place to sleep. Petty theft was a way of life for women, men, and children desperate to make it through another day. As a result, prisons across the British Isles were packed far beyond capacity. For nearly 100 years, England had routinely disposed of its convict population in the American colonies and built its rich empire on the backs of convict and slave labour. However, the American Revolution, followed by the abolition of slavery, eliminated this option. During the frenzied imperial land grab at the beginning of the 19th century, Great Britain could not persuade its proper citizenry to homestead its new colonies in Van Diemen's Land and in New South Wales. Few responded to ads in London newspapers seeking single women to populate a land where men outnumbered them 9 to 1. Parliament's solution was to conscript a slave labour force using the Transportation Act, an old law passed in 1718 that allowed prisoners to be shipped anywhere in the world. Originally crafted to be a humane substitute for the death penalty, it served a new purpose at the close of the 18th century. Under the pretense of justice, a greed-driven government expatriated the powerless. Ever since Captain James Cook's discovery of Australia in 1770, England resolved to keep it for herself. The Empire was especially concerned with France, its longtime enemy, which had already laid claim to Tahiti. Under the Transportation Act, 162,000 women, men, and children were exiled to Australia from 1788 to 1868. The legislation resolved several problems. It supplied cheap, disposable labour and removed the unsightly poor from Britain's shores. Most important, it provided a steady supply of young women who could serve as breeders for the Empire's newest crown jewel, Australia. Once the government shifted the focus of the Transportation Act to include more women, constables targeted and arrested female petty thieves in droves. The women were placed in irons, packed onto ships, and exiled to New South Wales and Van Diemen's Land, known today as Tasmania. Of the 25,000 sent, fewer than 2% had committed a violent crime, and 65% were first offenders. The Tin Ticket focuses on the women and children shipped to Van Diemen's Land, whose horrific journey and miraculous survival has largely been overlooked in written history. The tale unfolds through the eyes of the women themselves. Agnes McMillan was one of thousands of children cast into a system where the punishment far exceeded the scope of the crime. The Tin Ticket explores the background, the daily life, the brutal choices, and the surprising destiny of this struggling young girl who grew up in extraordinary times. Wandering Glasgow's back alleys in 1832, abandoned by her parents at age 12, Agnes McMillan could rely on no one but herself and her 13-year-old surrogate big sister, Janet Houston. Mates in the truest sense of the word, the two young lasses sacrificed neither loyalty nor hope as they travelled together to a land where even the stars in the sky seemed out of place and upside down. Friendship, ingenuity, and irreverent humour helped sustain Agnes and Janet as they came of age in the face of unimaginable hardship and humiliation. These same traits, their descendants suggest, permeate the Australian character today. Ludlow Tedder represents another important part of the convict women's story. Like many mothers, she was transported with her youngest child. A widow who worked as a maid, the mother of four never earned enough to make ends meet. In 1838, she lost poverty's gamble, which thousands of others took every day, when she pilfered 11 spoons and a bread basket from her employer. Tried for petty theft in London's Central Criminal Court, Ludlow was sentenced to 10 years in Van Diemen's Land with her 9-year-old daughter, Arabella. Innocent children suffered the same punishment as their mothers, and sometimes worse, yet their voices have been largely ignored, their existence buried in government reports. Ludlow and Arabella were forced to leave behind the rest of their family, and thus transport was a life sentence for them, because there was no way back. Arrested for minor crimes, tagged and numbered as chattel for forced migration to Australia, women like Agnes McMillan, Janet Houston, and Ludlow Tedder were identified in Newgate Prison and on certain ships by a tiny tin ticket hung around their necks. Surprisingly, these women, more sinned against than sinning, found an ally in Elizabeth Gurney Fry, a Quaker reformer whose tireless labours proved how simple acts of compassion can change the fate of many. Her influence brightened hope for the female convicts and paralleled their harrowing journeys from Newgate Prison to the transport ships and finally to the Cascades Female Factory in Van Diemen's Land. Fry's personal journal chronicles a deep understanding of what the convict women endured, including a description of the numbered tickets she placed around their necks on a red ribbon. The fateful tin tags are also mentioned in the second officer's report for the convict ship Garland Grove and in the diary of Lady Jane Franklin, the wife of the governor of Van Diemen's Land. A radical for her time, Elizabeth Fry was the first woman to speak before Parliament, lobbying on behalf of prison reform. Her diary reverberates with the power and the passion of her convictions, a revolutionary voice in the raging Victorian debate that deemed only men capable of reform and redemption. Believing that education and learning a skill could change the lives of the desperately poor, the forward-thinking Mrs. Fry set up a school for the children of convict women and taught their mothers how to sew while they awaited transport. Fry and her volunteers met with nearly half of the female transports. They boarded the convict ships and gave each prisoner a packet containing patchwork pieces, needles, and thread for stitching quilts that could later be sold in Australia. One such quilt, assembled aboard the convict ship Raja, during its 105-day voyage in 1841, was found stored in an attic in Edinburgh, Scotland, in 1987. Today, this treasure is housed in the National Gallery of Australia, stained with the blood and sweat of girls and women who would become colonial pioneers and founding mothers of modern Australia. Primary sources for the tin ticket meticulously document comprehensive and often surprising facts about the women's lives. For example, Agnes McMillan's court transcripts reveal her occupation. Age 12, ballad singer. Even the fact that her fence, Daniel Campbell, carried his belongings in a red handkerchief is carefully noted. Convict musters, archived by the Tasmanian government, describe each woman's physical characteristics, eye and hair colour, height, shape of face, shade of complexion, freckles, dimples, pockmarks. They also describe her demeanour, acts of rebellion, marriage applications, and where she lived and worked once freed. Details of time and place are drawn from original 19th-century documents, including ship's logs, newspaper accounts, letters and diaries written by ship officers, ship surgeons, police magistrates, and religious reformers. Trial and police transcripts, statements issued by the women, prison and orphan school records, and government publications, including select committee reports that investigated allegations of mistreatment and abuse. After 5 years of research, I returned to Australia in 2009 to complete my work. My first stop was Tasmania's capital, Hobart, and the ruins of the Cascades Female Factory. Once I finished my research in Hobart, I set out across Tasmania and then went on to mainland Australia, following the journey of the freed convict women portrayed in The Tin Ticket. I walked along the docks on Macquarie Street, where the women were paraded through crowds of hooting colonists. Under the shadows of Mount Wellington, I placed my hands on the prison's cold stone walls and viewed artifacts that offer a glimpse into the everyday lives of those who were transported. A tiny barred window that allowed only a sliver of light into the women's ward. The damp, solitary cell remains lying next to the Hobart rivulet, a stone washtub from Yard 2, perhaps the very one at which Agnes, Janet, and Ludlow spent their punishments and scraped their hands and elbows. Standing in the yard at midnight, I felt the chill left behind by the women and children who could not survive Cascades. My initial research led me to descendants of the women featured in The Tin Ticket. After corresponding with them for several years, I was graciously invited into their homes on my return trip to Australia. They shared extensive collections of family history, granting me access to information and secrets that, for some, had been suppressed for generations. In a remarkable coincidence, the three women whose lives I chose to study were at the Cascades Female Factory at the same time. Their lives intersected in ways that surprised me, as well as their descendant families. As the paper trail unfolded, I began to see through Agnes McMillan's eyes as her world changed from the black and white of the Glasgow Woolen Mills and Newgate Prison to the bright greens of untamed Tasmania, the Huon Forest, and later, the dusty goldfields in Victoria. In following the paths of the women and travelling with their descendants, we unearthed new facts about their lives that had been tucked away in used bookstores, small museum resource rooms, and the Archives Office of Tasmania. We discovered that Agnes McMillan's family had witnessed an event that shook the continent, the Eureka Rebellion. A former female convict helped sew the well-known blue and white Southern Cross flag raised during this workers' revolt. The rebellion would come to be known as the birth of Australian democracy, ignited by a furor over taxation without representation. It is estimated that at least one in five Australians and 2 million from the United Kingdom share convict ancestry. This has recently become a source of pride for many. When I asked 10-year-old Keely Milliken what she knew about her great-great-great-great-great-grandmother, Ludlow Tedder, she stood up very straight and replied, "She was a very strong woman." Father Peter Rankin, parish priest in Kilmore, Victoria, also expressed his admiration for the resourceful and enterprising women who had nothing and yet had it all, and emerged from the darkness of the ship's hold to become the light of Australia's future. The legacy of the transported women, once referred to as the convict stain, reveals new truths about a social engineering experiment that for nearly a century was covered up by both the British and the Australian governments. Not until the year 2000 was the practice of systematically destroying convict census records overturned by the Australian legislature. Fortunately, key records are intact for each woman featured in the tin ticket. In the final years of transportation, the aftermath of the Irish potato famine led to a marked increase in women and men from Ireland who were exiled for stealing food, livestock, and clothing. Often overlooked, the Irish had a profound effect on early colonial history. To help tell their story, I chose Bridget Mulligan. Had Bridget not survived the harsh sentence imposed because she was Irish, her great-granddaughter, Mary Binks, would not be running Gran's Van in 2010. Gran's Van is a mobile soup kitchen for the homeless and the needy in Devonport, Tasmania. Former Mayor of Devonport and a finalist for Australia's Local Hero Award in 2009, Mary is a living legacy to the important role convicts played in helping found modern Australia. During the 19th century, 25,000 women were discarded by their homeland. For many, that journey began with the accident of being born poor and the crime of stealing food or an article of clothing. Yet by sheer force of will, those who survived forged a promising future and became the heart and soul of a new nation. In marked contrast to Britain's rigid class system, freed convicts built, in record time, a society that enjoyed a vibrant economy alongside easy mobility between classes. Women who were banished by their home country saved a new colony from collapse, accelerated social change, and were among the first in the world to gain the right to vote and to own property. Their epic tale reveals universal themes involving the depths and heights of humanity, long suppressed intergenerational secrets, and the potential for nobility that lies within us all. Though some historians paint women like Agnes, Janet, Ludlow, and Bridget as harlots and criminals of the worst order, they were among the most resourceful and resilient women of their generation. Every breath and every step was a choice to survive, rather than succumb to their captors' cruelty. Theirs is a story of courage, transformation, and triumph. 1. The Grey-Eyed Girl. Bloody Christmas, Bloody Hell. The lush coastal hinterland offered a perfect day for Christmas 1869. The temperature was a lovely 75 degrees Fahrenheit. At the head of the table, Grandpa William rose from his seat, cleared his throat, and recited a prayer from the Bible. It was time to carve the traditional mutton and ham. Every December, the red flowers of the native Christmas bush came into bloom just in time for the holiday and filled the vases in the center of the handmade cedar table. On the sideboard, buttery cakes stacked with fresh fruit sat next to the cooling mince pie. Grandmum Agnes hurried to the kitchen and took a plum pudding out of the wood-fired oven. She brought it straight to the table and to the delight of the three-generation clan, set it aflame with brandy. Everyone knew what was coming next. A small silver sixpence had been surreptitiously placed inside. Whoever found it on his or her plate would enjoy good luck for the coming year. Agnes Macmillan Roberts already considered herself a lucky woman and counted her good fortune every single day. Just a year earlier, the British government had overturned the Transportation Act, a social engineering experiment that had exiled 162,000 women, men, and children from England, Ireland, Scotland, and Wales. 33 years ago, at age 15, Agnes had been shipped from Glasgow to Van Diemen's Land, present-day Tasmania, the small island off the southern coast of Australia. It had proven to be both a curse and a blessing. After the Christmas feast, Agnes moved to her favourite spot. Sitting on the sprawling porch, she looked out on her seven children and seven grandchildren, who came to visit Lismore every summer. Situated between the sea and the subtropical rainforest known as the Big Scrub, Lismore, Australia, had been founded by a Scotsman who had honeymooned on an island of the same name in Agnes's home country. The family matriarch had grown accustomed to seasons turned upside down from the land of lochs and northern lights where she was born 49 years ago. Although she still maintained a hint of the Scottish brogue, her secret past lay securely cloistered in the confidence of her husband William and her longtime childhood friend, Janet Houston. As her grandchildren played hide-and-seek along the banks of the Richmond River, Agnes chuckled at the skinny legs that peeked out from their short pants. She reached for a cup of hot India tea, freshly brewed to wash down the midday feast. Wisps of silver hair blew gently in the seasonable breeze, framing grey eyes the colour of steel and a gaze that seemed to go on forever. The same rare colour of the eyes of Athena, the Greek warrior goddess known for her strength and wisdom, Agnes's eyes mirrored these traits. Her Scottish eyes had witnessed the births and deaths of people and nations. Today, they sparkled in December's summer sun. The content matron, just over 5 feet tall, rocked back in her chair and considered how far she had travelled. Neither her children nor her grandchildren knew anything about Grandmum's early Christmases, including the one 37 years before that changed the course of her life and made theirs possible. She started to hum. It was an old melody, one her mother had taught her, one she had sung on the streets of Glasgow so many years ago. It was December 27, 1832. The gas lamps glowed in icy orbs that ran in crooked rows throughout the sleepy town. Even by Scotland's standards, the weather was horrid. Gale force winds from the west pelted heavy downpours onto the small faces that bobbed in and out from the protective doorways in the wynds by the green. It had been raining for days and days. Temperatures hovered just above freezing. "Bloody Christmas, bloody hell," muttered the street people. In a dense alleyway along the River Clyde, 12-year-old Agnes Macmillan shivered and huddled close to her friend Janet. Her breath billowed white and frosty, and she pulled what was left of a scarf over her nose. The two girls had eaten nothing for days but Irish apricots and had a taste for something other than potatoes.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?